This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Big Rock Candy Mountain by Wallace Stegner. Part 1. Chapter 1. The train was rocking through wide-open country before Elsa was able to put off the misery of leaving and reach out for the freedom and release that were hers now. She tucked her handkerchief away, leaned her shoulder against the dirty pane, and watched the telegraph wires dip and dip and dip from pole to pole, watched the trees and scattered farms, endless variations of white house, red barn, tufted cornfield, slide smoothly backward. Every mile meant that she was freer. The car was hot. Opened windows along the coach let in an acrid smell of smoke, and as the wind flawed, the trailing plume swept down past her eyes, fogging the trackside. Two men up ahead rose and took off their coats and came back toward the smoker. One of them wore flaming striped suspenders and stared at her. She turned her face to the window. The wires dipped, lifted, dipped, in swift curves like the flight of a swallow. She felt her stomach dipping and lifting with them. The tiny, thick locket watch that had been her mother's said 11 o'clock. They must be about 30 miles from home. Except for one visit to relatives in Iowa, she had never been so far from home in her life. By 11:30, the rocking of the car, the bite of the smoke smell, had begun to make her sick. Forlornly, she tried to brighten herself, sat straighter and stared harder, with a sick simulation of interest, at the country outside. But the wires dipped and lifted, her stomach lifted with every swoop of the wires, and she had to shut her eyes. Her face began to feel stiff, and there was a briny taste in her mouth. She swallowed. A preliminary spasm made her stand up, desperately, her throat locked against the surge of nausea. Staggering, clinging to the seats, she made her way back through the car, looking neither right nor left. There were toilets on trains, she knew, but she had no idea where. At the end of the car, seeing a man come out of a small side door, she made for it. Her hand was on the knob when she read the sign. Men. Sick shame gripped her. There were separate toilets then, and she had almost walked into the men's room. The women's must be at the other end. She would have to walk the whole way back, past all those people. A lurch of the car threw her sideways, and her throat muscles locked. In desperate haste, she went back between the plush seats, head down, burning with forlorn and miserable shame, the vomit in her very mouth. In the women's room, she retched, rose, tidied herself shakily before the smeared mirror, started to go out, and returned to retch again. It was so hot in the little cubicle that perspiration burst through her skin and left her sticky all over. Bathing her face in cold water helped, but then she discovered that there was no towel except a blackened rag. Her handkerchief was back in the seat. All she could do was to wait till her wet face dried. But the closet was too smothering. Instead of drying, she grew wetter. It was all she could do to stand. In a moment she was on her knees again, her lips wet with bitter gall. In despair, fearing that at this rate she never would get back to her seat, she washed again and dried her face on the lifted edge of her petticoat. Then back to the middle of the car, past passengers who looked at her, she was sure, with disgust or lurking smiles, until she fell into her seat with a half-sob and closed her eyes, feeling defiled and dirty and weak. People the length of the car were eating. Papers rattled, tin tinkled, and into the stuffy heat came the strong smell of peanut butter. Elsa's stomach rolled, and she gritted her teeth. She was resolving to do a half-dozen desperate things rather than go back in that women's room, when the train began to slow. The wheels pounded in a gradually lessening tempo, and the conductor poked his head in the door.
"Sioux Falls," he said.
Her lunchbox under her arm and her telescope in her hand, Elsa followed the crowding passengers out to the step. Her stomach was still queasy. She felt that her face must be green with nausea, and the station platform was strange and busy, but she clinched her mind around the thought of a rest, a stop. On a bench up under the protecting eaves of the station, she sat the full hour of the stopover, letting her stomach gradually settle and her muscles relax. After a long time, she opened her shoebox and tentatively nibbled a sandwich. It made her feel better, and she ate another, then a little square of cheese, then a piece of cake. By the time her train was ready, she could face the prospect of another 300 miles. Afterward, she found that the train no longer made her ill. Through the long, hot afternoon, she sat and watched the immediate trackside flowing straight as a river backward, the horizon revolving in a slow circle. There were few trees now. Somewhere, while she had been sick, they had come to some sort of dividing line. Farms were more scattered, the buildings unpainted, and either ramshackle or staringly new. There were no hills, only a wide, bare, green-gold plain, pasture and unthrifty-looking cornfields. Once in a while they came to creeks or rivers flowing turgidly in sandy beds between strips of dusty cottonwoods. Mile after mile, hour after hour, past sod shanties with weeds growing green on their roofs, past unpainted shacks and ragged sheds, past windmills and discouraged plantings of saplings, past fields of wheat still meadow green in the heat, past flocks of crows that flapped heavily off the wires as the train roared by, past herds of nondescript cattle with cowbirds sitting on their hip bones. The sun went down redly behind a ridge of scattered buttes, throwing into black relief the broken skyline and flushing a low range of hills beyond. Elsa ate from her lunchbox, watching the light die and the dark come up out of the ground. When they stopped at a town, the elevators loomed high and angular against the darkening sky, and the spout of a water tank outside the window was like the upraised trunk of a huge elephant. A little later, when it was black as a wall outside, the porter came in and lighted the kerosene lamps at the ends of the car. The girl leaned her head against the dark reflecting glass and watched the strange, unknown, lonely country flow past like a banner of darkness, starred with tiny, ephemeral lights. After a while she slept, and when she woke, they were in Fargo. There was a half-hour stop, and she got up to walk on the platform. On her second round through the group of workmen and trucks and strolling passengers, a man lifted his straw hat and smiled, and she stopped in surprise, thinking he must be someone she knew. But he was a total stranger, and the half-bow he made, the uplifted hat, the smirk on his face, put her to flight. She went in and sat down in the station restaurant and ordered a cup of coffee. After the momentary glad shock of thinking she had met an acquaintance, the depression of utter strangeness was on her again, accentuated by the flaring yellow lamps, the tired movements of the waitress, the midnight lackluster actions of the people sitting there, the dusty last year's calendar on the side wall telling her that it was December 24, 1904. She looked at the smoke-grimed hands and faces of the trainmen eating at the counter, the withered pies and bare, hard stools, and through the door at the yellow benches of the waiting room, and the sense of being alone, friendless, in a desolate land, rose in her like a sickness, so that she gulped her coffee and went out to the friendlier activity of the platform. The oppressive darkness crowded in from the far side of the tracks, pushing against the platform lights and the clustered yellow panes of the town. When at last the train started again, she sat for a long time, staring blankly into the solid black outside, looking past her faintly mirrored image and thinking of her father and Sarah and home. Her home seemed now very dear, her rebellion childish and petulant. Oppressed by her own loneliness, she could understand Sarah's now. Then she slept again, waking fitfully through an interminable, drowsy discomfort until the world outside lightened into color, emerging in flat lines of cloud and horizon and field. At 5:30 the conductor came through and shook her, thinking her still asleep. The next stop was Hardanger. She did not remember until she stepped off the train that she had entirely forgotten her uncle's instructions to wire him when she would arrive, and she had forgotten to tip the porter. Hurriedly she felt for her purse and started back, but the train was already moving. The conductor waved from the step, and she was alone, with the helpless feeling that everything she had done in getting there had been done wrong. The country about her was flat as a floor and absolutely treeless. On both sides of the tracks the town sprawled, new, temporary-looking, cut by rutted streets whose borders were a jungle of sweet clover and weeds. Across the roofs of two cottages Elsa could see the square, high fronts of stores on what seemed to be the main street. Toward them she started, pulled off balance by the weight of her telescope. As she passed the first cottage, a man in his undershirt threw open the door and stood in the sun, yawning and stretching and staring at her. The main street was a river of fine powder between the raised plank sidewalks. On both sides a row of hitching posts stood in vanishing perspective down to the end of the street, which trailed off weakly into open country. As she walked, looking for her uncle's store, Elsa saw with sick certitude that Hardanger was ugly. Frame buildings, false fronts, gaping, vacant lots piled with old barrels, boxes, blowing newspapers, ashes, dust-choked streets and sidewalks that were treacherous to walk on because sometimes the ends of the boards were loose. A general store whose windows were crammed with overalls, pitchforks, gloves, monkey wrenches, spools of barbed wire, guns, boxes of ammunition, ladies' hats. A butcher shop and bakery under the same roof, the windows of both opaque with fly specks. On the first corner a two-story frame hotel, its windows giving her a momentary glimpse of leather chairs and a disconsolate potted palm. A drugstore across the street, its sides plastered with advertisements for medicines. Next to that a vacant lot, then a pensioned railroad car set N2 to the street, and wearing on its front the legend, "Furs Bought for Cash." Another vacant lot, a store labeled "Gents and Ladies Haberdashery," a billiard hall and bowling alley, and then her uncle's store. Carl Norgaard, Plain and Fancy Groceries. But the store was closed. It was only, Elsa discovered by a look at her watch, 6:20. There was not a soul in the street. She was standing on the sidewalk, clasping and unclasping her fingers to restore the circulation after the weight of the telescope, when a young man came out of the pool hall. He was tall, slim, but heavy in the shoulders. His black hair was parted in the middle and pomaded flat over a forehead dark as an Indian's from the sun. His sleeves were rolled up to expose powerful arms, thick in the wrists and roundly muscled.
"Hello,"
he said, staring at her. Elsa flushed. The man had a merry and speculative glint in his eye. His stare bothered her as the smirk of the man at the station in Fargo had.
"You looking for somebody?"
Elsa stooped and picked up the telescope, some notion in her mind that that showed she was leaving in a minute.
"I was looking for my uncle, Mr. Norgaard. You don't know where he lives, do you?"
"Sure. Just down around the next corner. You can see it from here."
He came toward her with a slightly lurching stride, his shoulders swinging, and pointed to a gray frame house on the first cross street.
"Thank you,"
Elsa said, and started away. He followed her.
"You his niece? I could tell, though, by that hair."
Her hot, suspicious look made him laugh.
"No need to get mad. We all been expecting you."
"I was supposed to wire him," she said. "He didn't know when. Well, thank you for—"
"Can I lug that satchel for you?"
He kept pace with her, watching her, talking with a hidden burble of laughter in his voice.
"No thanks, I can carry it."
She hurried faster, and he stopped. But all the way to her uncle's house she could feel him watching her, and her mind's eye could see him standing in his shirt sleeves on the sidewalk with the sun on his dark face. It irritated her. There was something fresh about him. Carl Norgaard was not yet dressed when she knocked. After a moment his red head appeared in an upstairs window.
"Hello, Elsa! I thought you were going to wire me!"
She tilted back her head to smile at him, feeling suddenly very tired and hungry and soiled.
"I forgot, Uncle Carl. Can I come in anyway?"
"You betcha," he said.
Be down in a minute.
In a minute the door opened, and he was grinning at her, his pink, round face so full of welcome that she found herself laughing weakly aloud.
Willkommen, he said. Willkommen, Elsa.
Elsa unwound her scarf from her hat and said, Thanks, Uncle Carl. It's nice to be here at last.
You came in a hurry, Carl said.
He stood in his felt pantofles and regarded her with shrewd eyes.
How's everybody at home?
Fine, everybody's fine. But I had to come in a hurry, Uncle Carl. I couldn't stay there a minute longer.
Carl rubbed one apple cheek.
Well, you're young. Herrgott, the fool things you do when you're young.
He grabbed her by the arm.
Well, come in, come in. Come on upstairs. Want to wash your face? Take a bath? There's a tub in the cellarway. I'll heat some water.
Let me get my breath first, she said. Can I put this bag somewhere?
He showed her her room, led her into the other two upstairs rooms, one his own bedroom, one his office.
You might as well learn right away to leave the office alone, he said. I can't find anything as it is.
How about your bedroom? Can you sleep if I take off those dirty old sheets and put some clean ones on?
It was changed 2 weeks ago, Carl said. That's pretty good for an old batch.
He frowned.
Maybe I made a mistake letting you come. You get so neat a man can't stand you, and I'll send you home.
I'll be good, she said. I'll be as sloppy as you want, but don't send me home.
She took off her hat and lifted her hair with her fingers to ease its weight.
You go get a fire going, and I'll get your breakfast.
After breakfast, he went off to the store. In spite of his instructions to go to bed, she tidied up, swept, changed the beds, and laid out a washing for the next day, cleaned up the sardine cans and cracker boxes and cheese rinds from the kitchen. The curtains, she decided, had not been washed since the flood, and took them down to add them to the washing. Then she went up to her room and unpacked. By the time she had things put away, the telescope stuck into the attic and the daguerreotype of her mother set up on the dresser, she began to feel settled and permanent. The mere fact of working in this house made it her own. Her clothes hanging in the wardrobe gave her proprietorship. But when she sat on the bed and looked at the dark, thin-faced woman who had been her mother, she felt herself go slowly, weakly, sick with the old anger. Staring at the picture, rubbing her knuckles back and forth across her lips and teeth, she thought how her mother, too, had run away from home, younger than Elsa herself, no more than 17, and after 3 days let her parents know that she had married the carpenter on their place at Voss in Norway. She risked everything for him, and got only him. He was below her. They never took her back. Within 6 months she was on her way to America, where for a life she had the back-breaking work of a Minnesota farm, she who had never been used to working at all. It was a short life. Elsa was 15 when her mother died, worn out at 34, and it was Elsa who took up the work her mother had let go. She had father, sister, brother to take care of. The school she had dropped out of at 14 to nurse her mother saw her no more. And then, less than 3 years after that lingering death they had all had to watch too closely, Nels Norgaard announced he... Elsa shut her eyes down hard on the smart of tears. "It isn't only that Sarah is 20 years younger than he is," she said silently to the empty, strange room. "It's that she was supposed to be my best friend." Counting up what she had left behind her forever, she saw them all as if their faces were propped on the dresser beside her mother's daguerreotype. Her father's stern, long-cheeked face, slashed across by the guardsman's mustache, his eyes merely veiled, unreadable. Sarah, in the posture she had been reduced to by Elsa's anger and scorn, stooped over, weeping, with a slack mouth and flooded gray eyes that said, "Pity me, pity me." Erling's corkscrew red curls and red farm boy's face emerging from the blackened towel by the kitchen cistern pump. Kristen's awed, aghast, pretty face in the bedroom when she found Elsa packing. The affected pompadour and the vain ribbons and the whispering voice full of love, kinder than spoiled little sister had ever sounded.
Won't you take that hat I made last week? You could wear it on the train. It'd look lovely with your hair. It's green.
And then the tempest of tears.
She knew already that she would miss them more than she had ever thought possible. She ached for them this minute. She could even have been respectful to her father and pleasant to Sarah. Maybe. And yet, what else could she have done?
From the dresser, the daguerreotype looked back at her calmly, the lips compressed. It was not a good likeness, and like all pictures of the dead, it had petrified the memory of the living, so that every recollection Elsa had of her mother was now limited by this stern and pinched expression. Her mother had been ill when the picture was taken, perhaps for that reason, perhaps because of the narrowing of memory to fit the one picture she had. Elsa had always felt the daguerreotype to be a portrait of martyrdom.
"More," she said in Norwegian, groping for some contact or reassurance. "Mom."
Out the window she saw a summer whirlwind spinning across the level fields beyond the flanks of the town. The funnel of dust lifted, dropped again, whirled forward across a road, stopped and spun, moved off in jerky rushes like a top spinning on an irregular surface. It hit a mound of dumped refuse and tin cans rolled, papers sailed flatly, slid back, groundward. Beyond the whirlwind was the prairie running smoothly, the plained horizon broken by two far homesteads, ships on the calm green bronze sea, and far beyond, the glitter from the moving blades of a windmill. It was very big. She felt she could see a long way, even into the future, and she felt how the world rolled under her. After she had watched the summer plains for a long time and the smarting under her lids had passed, a meadowlark sang sharp and pure from a fence-post, and she began to think that the future into which this new world of her choosing moved with her could hardly be unfriendly, could hardly be anything but good.
Chapter 2
"Elsa," Carl Norgaard said, "how'd you like to go to a ball game?"
He was sitting at the kitchen table opening a jar of gammelost with a screwdriver. Elsa turned from the stove.
"Are you going?"
"They couldn't play without me," Carl said. "I've closed the store for every ball game in 15 years.
"Sure," she said. "I'd love to."
He bore down with the screwdriver, prying at the lid. The blade slipped, and he leaped up with a startled howl.
"Van slut!" he said.
He shook his fingers, and the blood welling from his gouged palm spattered on the floor.
"Heste lort!"
Carl said, almost jumping up and down. For a full minute he swore savagely in Norwegian, looked at Elsa, bent his lips into a baffled, half-humorous smirk, and looked back at his hand. She came running with the iodine bottle and soused the wound. Carl swore again.
"Shame on you," she said.
"Well, hell,"
Carl said. He looked at the deep gouge in his palm and shook his head incredulously.
"You haven't got any business knowing what I said," he said. "That's the trouble, having a Norske girl around."
Elsa giggled. "Anyway, you sounded good and mad," she said. "Norwegian swearing sounds 10 times worse than English, somehow. It's just like ripping canvas."
"I guess you'd swear, too," he said. "Dug my whole damn hand out."
"If there was any of that smelly old cheese on the screwdriver, you'd be infected, sure," Elsa said. She tore a strip off a clean cloth and started bandaging.
"You mean you don't like gammelost?"
Elsa made a face. "Erling put some on my knife once, just stuck the knife in the jar and then laid it beside my plate, and I was sick for 2 hours.
"You're a traitor," Carl said. "You don't like lutefisk either?"
"No, nor herrings." He shook his pink head over her.
"But you like ball games?"
"Ball games are all right."
"Well, you better like them," Carl said. "You just better like them."
He went out to the store, muttering, shouting back that she used batter be ready at 2 o'clock or a little before, and she saw him stomping through the sweet clover cross lots to the store, holding his gouged hand tenderly against his stomach. It was a blistering day. The ground, when they walked out at 2 o'clock, was dry and baked, with cracks splitting through the yellow grass of the yard. What had once been a mud puddle in the road was caked into 100 cupped plates laid together like a Chinese puzzle. Elsa picked one up. It took all the strength of her fingers to break it. Around them, the sweet clover, just drying into clusters of seeds, was bone-stiff and dusty. West of the town, 3 whirlwinds raced and dipped and lifted over the flats. They walked past the 2 grain elevators, across the cindery, fire-bitten tracks. On the other side, a tier of crude seats was already well filled. Buggies lined the edge of the field, crowded with women under big parasols of fringed canvas, faded from the fierce sun. There was a persistent flash of paper fans. A booth wound with red, white, and blue bunting was doing a land office business in lemonade and pop and ice cream. There were bottles and papers littered along the weedy edge of the diamond. Standing below the plank seats, Elsa felt people's eyes on her. Men spoke to Carl, and he grinned, squinting up into the sun, saying, "Hello, Gus. Hello, George. Hello. Ought to be a hot game." "We got it on ice," somebody said, and there was a laugh. Feeling conspicuous, Elsa stood silently under her big hat while her uncle picked out a place in the stands. Then someone was calling from a buggy over on the first baseline. "Come on over here. You'll melt down to grease in that stand." "Ah," Carl said, "there's Helm. That'll be better." The woman who had called beckoned. Elsa saw a broad, dark face, a wide hat, a shapeless body, and a loud, intolerably hot-looking dress, a cluster of children. Then they were at the wheel of the buggy, and Carl was saying, "This is Helm, Elsa. Never call her Mrs. Helm, or she'll burst a blood vessel." Grinning with bad teeth, Helm stuck down a broad hand, her dark eyes running over every detail of the girl's hair, dress, face. At the first clutch of her hand, Elsa thought her knuckles would crumble. She flushed, grew angry, and squeezed back with all her strength until she felt her knuckles slip back into line, and the broad palm in hers begin to give. For an instant more they gripped each other until Helm opened eyes and mouth in astonishment. "My God!" she said loudly. "You're strong as a horse. Where'd you get it?"
"Milking cows," Elsa said sweetly. "Give me another chance and I'll squeeze your fingernails off," she thought. She wished Carl hadn't brought her over here.
"Come on up,"
Helm said. She stuck down her hand again and in one mighty heave hauled the girl up beside her, where she inspected her again, closely, with brown, shining eyes.
"You ain't so light, either. How much do you weigh?"
"I don't know. 130 or 135.
"I got you by 100 pounds, honey," Helm said. She rumbled with laughter, and her thick fingers pinched experimentally at Elsa's arm. "You don't dint easy, either. First off, I had you pegged for one of these ladies with fainting spells and weak chests."
Jammed uncomfortably close to Helm's radiating bulk, Elsa looked around into the box of the Democrat at the clot of children there. Helm caught her looking.
"Ain't that a brood for you? They all look like their grandpa. He was a Sioux Indian."
"Are you?" Elsa said.
"Half," Helm said. "The best half, if there's any choice."
She picked at a tooth with her fingernail, her eyes warm behind the broad hand.
"Their old man was a good-for-nothing," she said. "After he got all these, he run off and left me with a shape like a bale of hay. Good riddance to bad rubbish."
She got whatever she was digging for and took her hand away.
"You like baseball?"
"Very much,"
Elsa said stiffly. She didn't know what to make of this great vulgar woman, but Carl, sprawling on the grass beside the buggy, must have thought she was all right, or he wouldn't have come to sit with her.
"This ought to be a good game," Helm said. "We got a team last few years. Got a catcher used to play in the 3i League."
"Oh?"
"You watch him. He's a one. Bo Mason's his name."
"He runs the bowling alley next to my store," Carl said. "If he didn't have a trick knee, he'd be in the big leagues."
"Oh," Elsa said.
"I think I met him the morning I came. Is he dark, sort of slim, looks slimmer than he really is?"
"That's him," Helm said. "Parts his hair in the middle and a hide like shoe leather."
A minute later she pointed. "In the blue shirt," she said. Elsa looked and saw the young man of that first morning. As he said something to a companion, his teeth were very white in his almost negroid face. She wondered how he got so dark running a bowling alley. That would keep him inside, out of the sun, she would think. And she didn't know whether she liked his looks or not. There was a kind of rolling swagger in his walk, and as the home team pegged the ball around the infield, he kept making bright remarks, a little of the smart-aleck in him. But he was as good as they said he was. In the very first inning he caught an Oasis man trying to steal second, caught him by 3 feet with a perfect ankle-high peg. After that the opposing base runners took short leads and went down only with the crack of the bat. When he came up to bat the first time, Mason was out on a screaming grass-cutter that the first baseman tried in vain to get out of the way of, but in the fifth he drove in 2 runs with a thunderous triple that chased the center fielder far back in the wild mustard. Helm, pounding Elsa on the back, announced 3 times that it would have been a homer sure except for that trick knee. In the seventh inning the score was tied 8-8. The first 2 Oasis hitters were easy outs. The next one was a slugger. The stocky youngster on the mound took his time, mopping his neck with a bandana between pitches. Squatting on his hams behind the plate, Beau Mason talked it up. "Easy out, easy out. Give him the old dark one." The pitcher wound up and threw. Strike! The hitter swung so hard he had to put the end of his bat down to keep from falling. "You need a little oil on your hinges, son," Mason told him, and the stands hooted. Next pitch, ball. Next one, ball again. Mason's soothing voice went right out over the infield. "All right, boy. Can't hit what he can't see. Right down the old alley. Let him swing like a shutter in a cyclone. Feed it to him. He's got a glass eye." The next pitch was grooved, and the Oasis slugger rode it deep into left field. The fielder lost it in the sun, and the runner went down to second, his feet pumping quick explosions in the dust. A strained look showed him the fielder was still chasing the rolling ball, and he legged it for third, where the players on the sidelines waved him frantically home. Mason, his teeth showing in his dark face, waited spraddle-legged in front of home plate. The relay from the shortstop reached him 2 steps ahead of the runner, who swerved, skidded, and scrambled back for third. He was in the box. The crowd was on its feet, yelling as Mason chased him carefully back, holding the throw. He faked, then threw, and the runner reversed and tore for home again, but the ball was there before him and the catcher blocked the baseline. The Oasis man put his head down and butted through under Mason's ribs, and Mason, as he was plowed out of the path, lifted the ball and tagged him hard on the top of his bare head. The sound of ball on skull cracked in the heat, and the grandstand let go a long, shivering, "Oh!" This might mean a fight. They stood higher in the stands, eyes joyful and faces expectant. "Attaboy, Beau," they said. "That's the old way to slow 'em down." Carl Norgaard was standing by the buggy wheel, his pinkish hair damp. He was concentrating on the figure of the Oasis man, slowly pushing himself up from the dust with his flat palms. Carl's voice rose with him in the expectant hush, thin, tremulous, sing-song. "Better we get a doctor? I tank he been sunstruck." The stands exploded in mirth that rode the thick, hot air and echoed off the elevators. The Oasis man scowled, looking at Mason, standing just off the baseline with the ball in his hand. Contemptuously, Mason pulled off his mitt and turned his back, walking over to the Hardanger bench. With his head down, the Oasis man started after him, pursued by the hoots of the spectators, who began to jump down from the lower tiers to get in on the scrap. But other Oasis players grabbed their fellows' elbows and held him while he stood in the clover, fists balled, swearing. Then, abruptly, he jerked himself loose and ran back into center field, and the crowd settled back. After that, there wasn't much to the game. Hardanger batted around in the eighth. The final score was 16-9. After the game, Helm yelled until Beau Mason came over, and as he stood talking at the buggy wheel, Elsa forgot her dislike for his smart-aleck streak. He was the best player there was no question. but his grin embarrassed her when they were introduced, and she sat back in the hot, sweaty alley between Helm and the rail and let the others talk.
"What were you trying to do, kill that guy?"
Carl said. Mason laughed.
"He ran me down, didn't he? He wants to play rough. I can play rough, too."
"I bet he can't get his hat on for a week," Helm said. "How about some beer? You look hot, Bo."
"You could fry eggs on me," Mason said. "Sure, over at your place."
Elsa, sitting uncertainly beside Helm, caught her uncle's grin.
"You want to come along, Elsa?"
The girl flushed and laughed.
"I don't drink beer," she said,
and was furious at how squeaky her voice sounded. They laughed at her, and Helm patted her on the back with a hand like a leg of lamb.
"You don't have to, honey," she said. "We can take care of that."
Chapter 3 In the hot morning hush, Elsa walked down the plank sidewalk toward her uncle's store. There wasn't enough housework to keep her busy more than a few hours a day, even on Mondays, when she washed, and Saturdays when she baked. It was a problem to know what to do with her time. Unlike her father, Carl did not have many books around, and though he had given her money to subscribe to the Ladies' Home Journal, the first number hadn't come yet. She could have called on Helm, but the prospect was still a little terrifying. As she thought over that afternoon with the beer drinkers, she felt a little weak. They had all got a little tipsy, they had laughed uproariously, they had told jokes that she knew weren't quite clean, and she had just pretended not to hear. Before long, if she didn't watch out, she wouldn't know what was respectable and what wasn't.
"Fiddlesticks," she said. "What was wrong about it?" But she didn't quite dare call on Helm.
In the window of the hotel, she caught sight of her reflection and was pleased. The white dress, perfectly ironed, not yet wilted by the heat, the red hair puffed like a crown in front, the round, erect figure, slim in the waist, full-breasted. When she walked past three young men lounging on the sidewalk, she stepped self-consciously. Feeling their eyes on her, she hurried a little in spite of herself. She was 10 steps past when she heard the low whistle and the voice, "Ooh, you kid." She remembered the time she had bloodied George Moe's nose for him when he got smart about her hair. Men were just the same. They'd say smart aleck things, and if you turned on them, even if you bloodied their noses, they'd laugh even more. But she would have liked to say something sharp to that loafer. "Oh, you kid." The smart alecks. But anyway, the next window told her she looked nice, cool as a cloud. In front of her uncle's store she almost ran into Beau Mason, bareheaded, his pomaded hair sleek as a blackbird's breast. As he looked at her, his eyes were sleepy, the full upper lids making them narrower than they really were. His voice was slow and warm.
"Hello?"
"Hello."
"Going somewhere?"
"No, just looking around."
"Seeing the city?"
He lifted his head to laugh, and she saw the corded strength of his neck. He pointed down the street to the weed-grown flats dwindling off into dump ground and summer fallow.
"You must take a stroll in the park," he said. 5,000 acres of cool greenery. This is one of the show towns of Dakota. Prosperous. Did you see that magnificent hotel on the corner as he came by? Gilded luxury, every chamber in it. The fulfilled dream of one of Hardanger's most public-spirited citizens."
Elsa was a little astonished. She said demurely,
"Very imposing. Bath in every room?"
"Some rooms, too. So a man and his wife can both be clean, same time."
"Must take a lot of water."
"Oh, they got water to burn. Gigantic well just outside. Clean, pure alkali water. No more than 7 dead cats in it at any time."
"You don't sound as if you liked the hotel much."
"I love it," he said. "I love it so much I live there. I love this whole town. Just the spot for an ambitious young man to make his fortune."
Curiosity uncoiled itself and stretched. She took a peek at the swinging doors behind him. Maybe he wasn't doing so well in his place. Bowling alley, was it? All she could see was a dark stretch of bar and 2 dim yellow lamps in wall brackets. Into the bright, hot sunlight came the jaded click of pool balls.
"What are you doing, really?" Beau said.
"Nothing. I thought I might help Uncle Carl in the store."
"Let's go have a soda."
Elsa hesitated, her eyes on the darkly polished bar inside. It looked almost like a saloon, but she knew saloons were prohibited in North Dakota. Her curiosity rose on tiptoe, peering.
"Why, that'd be nice," she said.
Instead of turning into his own place, he took her arm and led her down to the corner.
"Why can't we have it in your place?" she said. "Then you wouldn't have to pay for it."
His look was amused. "You want to go in my place?"
"Why not?"
"Nah," he said, and moved her along. "My place is a billiard hell. It's a man's joint. You'd scare away my two customers."
"But you sell drinks, though. Soft drinks?"
"Soft enough. But Joe down here makes better sodas."
She wondered if he might be running an illegal saloon. That ought, according to what the Reverend Jacobson had always said, to make him one of the undesirable element. Looking at him again curiously, she saw only that he looked clean, brown, athletic. She didn't ever recall seeing a man who looked so clean. Either the respectability she had been brought up in was narrow, or Beau Mason wasn't one of the bad element. But he drank beer and told stories that weren't always quite nice. But so did her uncle, and he was respectable. And so did Helm, and Helm was a woman. Sitting at the sticky marble slab of counter sipping sodas, they laughed a great deal and gurgled through the newfangled straws. By the time she had left him to go home, she had decided that he couldn't possibly be one of the bad element in spite of his billiard hell. The bad element were distinguishable by their evil faces, their foul mouths, their desire to trample everything decent and clean underfoot. Beau Mason wasn't anything like that. He was cleaner than anything. Even while he stood on the sidewalk just before she left, he was trimming his nails with his pocket knife. She noticed, too, how cleanly the blade cut the thick, soft nail, and she was enough a farm girl to respect a man who kept his tools sharp. Moreover, he had been all over, worked at a dozen different things, talked easily about Chicago and Milwaukee and Minneapolis, the places that had been golden towers on her horizons for 18 years. The thought of what her father might say if he knew she had had a soda with a man who ran a pool hall made her almost laugh aloud. Even if he ran an undercover saloon, blind pigs, they called them, it didn't make any difference. She was a grown woman, and could have sodas with anyone she chose. If she found a saloon keeper who was clean and interesting and pleasant, she would have a soda with him any time she pleased. The sidewalk ended, and she jolted herself, stepping unexpectedly down. As she passed Helm's yard, she heard the racket, the shrill, snapping snarl of a dog, Helm's voice swearing, the sudden yipe of a mongrel hurt.
"Now, goddammit, will you lay still?"
she heard Helm say. The dog yiped again, and as Elsa stopped at the gate, its voice went up in a high wail. She must be killing it, Elsa thought. She found herself at the side of the house, looked around the corner. In the corner of the fence, Helm was kneeling. Her wide stern loomed like the gable of a barn. Then she rose, grabbed a handful of dry grass, stood back. The moment the pressure was off him, the dog tucked his tail and hiked. Helm, starting back toward the kitchen, saw Elsa and scowled red-faced.
"A son of a bitching kids," she said.
The Reverend Jacobson, Elsa's mind said, would have told anyone to walk away from language like that, but she stayed where she was.
"What was the matter?" she said.
"They're allus doing something like that," Helm said. "Tying cans to dogs' tails, or tying cats' tails together and throwing them over a clothesline, or catching frogs and blowing them so full of air they can't swim. I catch any of them, I'll lay into them, I don't care who they are."
"What did they do?" Elsa said.
"First time I ever see this one," Helm said. "It's a dirty damn trick, even on a cur dog. They fed this met a ball of string wrapped up in meat or something, I guess, and before he knows it, he's trailing yards of it out behind, and everybody's stepping on it fit to pull his guts out. Ain't that a dirty trick now?
Elsa tried to keep her eyes up. She felt the slow red coming into her face. She ought to have gone right on by, then she wouldn't have got trapped like this. Helm, watching her with shining eyes, began to smile.
Why, honey, I believe that shocked you.
I think it's an awful dirty trick, Elsa said.
I forgot you was a lady, Helm said. I didn't aim to shock you. First minute I talked to you, I knew you was a lady, a natural-born lady, not one of these dames with stud-horse airs. I wouldn't want to shock you any time. But I couldn't let that hound run around that way, could I?
No, Elsa said. I think you're very kind.
She escaped, feeling almost as if she were going to cry, because Helm was kind. That was a kind-hearted thing to do, and all the bad language and vulgarity that went with it couldn't make it any less kind. She went about getting lunch, feeling as if a bed were unmade in her mind. Not all the people she met were as hard to assimilate as Helm and Beau Mason. Most of them she met at Helm's house, and most of them were commonplace enough. Gus Sprague, a little bandy-legged carpenter, was ordinary and pleasant. So was his wife, as little and hen-like and bandy-legged as Gus. And the elevator man, Bill Consett, was nice, too. Bill's belt cut so low under his pendant stomach that small boys were always following him around, waiting for his pants to fall off. There was a little group of Norwegians who sometimes came around, but they stuck together and were more pious than the rest, a little more like Indian Falls. Carl was the only Norsky who seemed to have left the old country completely behind. None of those people was disturbingly new, but Judd Chain and Eva Alsop were. Judd Chain was a professional gambler and Beau Mason's partner. Knowing that before she met him, Elsa expected almost anything, a sinister, pale, diabolic creature with burning nighttime eyes was what her anticipation finally resolved itself into. But the man she met one afternoon in Helm's cluttered parlor was a handsome blonde giant, 6 feet 3 or 4 inches tall, abnormally wide in the shoulders. The only part of him that matched her imaginings was his pallor, and even that was not the evil midnight thing she had expected. She shook his hand in confusion, this beautifully groomed, sleek, white-handed gentleman. His smile was friendly, his eyes gentle, his manners impeccable. When he moved around bringing her a cup of coffee or pulling up a chair so that they could talk more comfortably, he moved with easy grace, and when he bent over to listen to something she was saying, she smelled the bay rum on his pocket handkerchief. He was like Beau Mason, fascinating in a way no man in her life had ever been fascinating before. He had traveled around even more than Beau, even to Cuba and South America. He said he had been working with Beau for 3 years now, and when she said she hadn't seen him around town, his eyes smiled. His work, he explained, kept him up all night sometimes. He was generally asleep in the daytime. So there he was, her amazed mind said. A card sharp. Another like Beau, from the class of people all the good people of Indian Falls would consider outside the pale. Yet he was handsome, almost as imposing physically as Beau, though more willowy and fragile-looking in spite of his wide shoulders. His hands were immense, flat, slabby, with wide palms and long fingers, the nails trimmed round. She could imagine how deftly he could handle cards. A gambler, a sharper, yet more gentlemanly, deferential, polite than anybody she had ever met. She spilled coffee on her dress at the thought of herself sitting next to this dangerous man and talking, as if she had known him forever. Instantly the bay rum-scented handkerchief was out, his languid ease galvanized into careful helpfulness. If she had spilled anything at home among the men she knew, they would have stared at her with their hands on their knees and done nothing. Judd Chain could make any woman think she was both fragile and charming. A few days later she met Eva Alsop, and that was another sort of experience. Small, doll-like, blonde, she looked the part of the bad woman. Her laugh was too loud, and when she was serious her mouth had a weary and petulant droop. Once in a while she placed her hand on her side and if anyone caught her doing it, she looked up with a wan, brave smile. To her, Judd Chain was as deferential as he was to Elsa, but even Elsa's inexperience detected a difference, a certain familiarity, a subtle knowingness in the way Eva looked at him, and when Judd rose to go that afternoon, saying he had business to attend to, Elsa saw the wizened petulance on Eva's mouth, a very red mouth, redder than she had ever seen a mouth before. Judd bent elegantly over her, said something the others could not hear, but Eva's eyes, as she watched him take his hat and leave, were cold. Helm talked about her afterward. "Eva Milksop," she called her. "She's a little sniveling cheap slut," Helm said. "Common as manure, making out she's the grandest lady you ever seen. Paints her face and bleaches her hair and dolls herself up like Mrs. Astor's plush horse. She makes my belly ache, her and her pains."
"Well, maybe she is sick," Elsa said.
"How would you act if you had a pain?" Helm said. "Would you go around whining and holding your belly and making everybody feel like a son of a bitch if you didn't run right out for the hot water bottle?"
"I guess
you damn betcha you wouldn't. You'd try to grin if you had the god-awfulest bellyache in the world. You're two different kinds of people, honey. Don't go wasting sympathy on that canary-legged little slut."
"There must be some good in her," Elsa said. "Anybody's got some good in him."
"There's about as much good in her as there is in my backside," Helm said. "And that's mainly lard. You see her shrivel up and get mean when Judd had to go?"
"Yes, I wondered." "Is she in love with him?"
Stacking the coffee cups, Helen made a prissy face. "If she ever decides to hook up with Judd, she'll decide it when Judd makes a killing. She ain't going into no nest without a lot of feathers in it."
"Well," Elsa said, "live and learn. I never knew there were so many kinds of people."
Helm stood with her legs planted as if she were going to give a lecture. She was. "If you're the right kind yourself, you'll find the right kind," she said. "There's not many people'll do anything for you but kick you when you're down. I aim to save my kicks for the butterbutts and give anybody that's down a hand instead of a foot."
"Maybe Eva's down."
"She's one of the butterbutts," Helm said. "I like the kind of people that don't play they're something they ain't. I'm a sucker, honey. Don't try to learn anything from me. A fella that's down on his luck, or some simple guy that the world is kicking around, or somebody that's straight out what he is so I don't have to keep jumping around to know what I'm dealing with. Those are my kind of folks. Every hobo that ever hit this town was on my back step in half an hour," she snorted, folding freshly ironed clothes into a basket. "Just a softy," she said. She looked up under her eyebrows, still stooping. "You lonesome for home, honey?"
"Sometimes," Elsa said. "I miss the kids. They were pests when I had to take care of them, but I miss them just the same. I miss Pa, too, I guess. Only he's married again and everything."
"Married a girl a lot younger, didn't he?"
"My best friend,"
Elsa said. She couldn't even yet mention that without being angry and hurt. "Yeah," Helm said. "It's funny. When you're a kid, something like that can smell like a carcass, and after you get older, it don't seem so bad. You liked your ma a lot, didn't you?"
"I took care of her a long time," Elsa said. "That was what made me so mad. I don't think he ever went to her grave, even. I went just before I left, and it was all overgrown with weeds, right when he was going around with Sarah."
Helm sighed wheezily, stuck a thumb down inside the chafing edge of her corset, and wriggled a fold of skin into place. "You're all right, honey," she said. "You stick by the things you love. Nobody can hurt you if you stick with what you know is right. It can't hurt what's inside you."
Chapter 4
"That Beau Mason gets away with murder," Elsa said. "Why don't people tell him where to head in at?"
"Oh, that's just Bo," Carl said. "If it was anybody else, you'd knock his head off."
"That doesn't excuse him," she said. "He was just plain mean to Eva."
"I guess Eva sort of has it coming," he said, and steered his way up the stairs to bed. Elsa tidied up the downstairs, thinking of the way Beau had acted. The way he'd said to Eva, "For God's sake, come down off your high horse and quit acting like the Duchess of Dakota. Can't you walk without looking like Dan Patch in hobbles?" The way he caught up everything anyone said all evening and turned it back with a sting in it. The way he had sat while Helm and Eva and Carl and Judd were playing whist and bullied her for an hour and a half because she didn't even know how to play casino. How would she know how to play casino when her father had never even allowed a deck of cards in the house? She had seen him that way once before over at Helm's, and she suspected that he was mad about the way his bowling alley was doing. Sometimes he seemed restless and dissatisfied. When he got to thinking about that too long, she supposed, it brought on one of these black and contrary moods. Or maybe it might have been only something someone had said, something he took it into his head to be mad about. He was as vain as a boastful little boy. But that didn't excuse his going through a whole evening the way he had, smiling as if he had a knife ready to stab somebody, jumping from bald insults to compliments as suave as butter that were more insulting than the insults. He was a hard man to understand, she thought, as she went upstairs with the lamp. You never knew how you'd find him. But why should she worry herself about the way he acted? Let him go on being moody and sardonic and insulting. Yet she found herself later asking people about him. Carl Helm, even Judd Chain. How could a man be so many contrary things at once? How, for instance, could anyone have grown up and never been inside a church? He said he hadn't. Yet in a good mood he could be so very pleasant and thoughtful. There was a kind of warmth that radiated from him when he wanted to let it. And how had he come to be so good at everything he did? He was the best ball player in town. Helm assured her that he was also the best shot, the best bowler, the best pool player, and one of the two best skaters. "But where did he come from?" Elsa asked. "What's he doing out here?" "He's from Illinois," Helm said. "Rock River. His old man wasn't much good, I guess. They just let his family run loose. I've heard him talk about it once or twice, just odds and ends of things." That was all Elsa got, odds and ends, scraps that could be pieced together into a skeleton biography. She did not admit to herself, did not even think about, the unusual eagerness she had to reconstruct that biography. She did not say to herself that he was the most masterful, dominating, contradictory, and unusual man she had ever met. But she picked up everything she heard nevertheless, and she pumped Beau himself when he came over in the evening to sit on the steps and talk. When Fred Mason came home to Illinois from the war in 1865, he had left an arm somewhere in a field hospital near Vicksburg, and most of his disposition in the Andersonville prison. In the 10 years after his arrival, he successfully married a Pennsylvania Dutch girl of broad dimensions, begot 7 children, and became the nucleus and chief yarn spinner of the livery stable crowd. For money, he depended on his pension and a few scattered odd jobs. Working for anyone else tired him. Orders were more than his irascible individualism would stand.
"Nobody in my family ever took orders from anybody," he used to say. "My pap come into this state when she was nothing but oak and Indians, and he never took no orders from any man. Neither did his pap or his pap's pap. I'm the only one ever did, and I only did in the army, and I don't take no more." He spent his days lounging at the stable, talking bird dogs and battles. Once in a while he took over a job in a burst of ambition to augment his pension, because though he was not especially a drinking man, he loved to eat, and his shapeless and rather sullen hausfrau couldn't make the pension stretch to cover much more than sow belly and eggs. Often, too, he sat in the sun with the fecund stable smell about him and a coach dog dozing among the flies, and generated great schemes. He invented, on paper or in drawings sketched in the dust with a twig, all sorts of gadgets. Revolvers with 12 chambers, a telescopic ramrod that could be carried in the vest pocket, a folding bootjack, an artificial arm that could be moved by a complicated system of wires and pulleys, with a miniature ice tongs for a hand. He even went to work and whittled out the arm, laboriously fitted it with pulleys and strung the wires,
But when he had a fellow loafer strap it on him and tried it out before the eyes of his crowd, he got tangled up and bit himself in the ribs with the ice tongs. In a fury, he threw the whole contraption in the Rock River. His six boys and one girl grew up untended in the shambling old frame house his wife had brought him.